I couldn't sleep at all last night.
Welcome all you sunrisers and moonrisers to Sleepless in Studio City, a safe place for discussing what's keeping your mind, body, and spirit from sweet sound slumber. Your host, Dr. Debs, a celebrated columnist, lauded love, romance, relationship, and dating coach, offers simple, soothing solutions and heartfelt help. Dr. Debs will discuss topics such as finding and keeping the love you deserve, dating, marriage, parenting, setting boundaries, breaking the cycle, breaking up, following your dreams. We respect your privacy and will not reveal names or contact info. If you'd like your questions answered during a show but are hesitant to call in, please feel free to write Dr. Debs at sleeplessinstudiocity@gmail.com and she will address your concerns on the next broadcast. You can also find updates and weekly affirmations on Facebook/sleeplessinstudiocity. And now, without further ado, here's Dr. Debs.
Thank you, Zach, for that lovely introduction. Always a pleasure and honor to be here with all you night owls for another exciting episode of Sleepless in Studio City. And stay tuned for our magical musical interlude. We're going to be presenting the stunning singer, writer, arranger, Gina Kronstadt. She's going to be performing an original tune called Magic from her CD entitled Come Over, with John Beasley on the Rhodes, Christian McBride upright bass, Gary Novak on drums, Louis Conte percussion, Bob Shepherd on sax, and a string section led by Joel DeRowan. You won't want to miss this. I was thinking about time. Time is on your side. Yes, it is. Time to every purpose under heaven. What a great New Year's resolution to manage your time. Time management, what is that? Every hour, every minute, every second is precious, and you deserve to treat it like the gem it is, the treasure, the pot of gold. Many say if you abuse time, you're abusing God's gift to you. Then, of course, once it's gone forever. You can't add more time. You can't subtract time. You can't multiply time. You can't speed it up, slow it down. You can't allocate it. It's non-renewable, non-recoverable, irreplaceable. We all have the same amount of time. So how do you maximize your minutes? Are you doing things you love? Are you using your spiritual gifts to serve others? Are you taking control over time? Do you spend your time on activities you love, or are you letting others dictate where, when, how, what? Are you afraid to stop and feel silence or stillness? Do you consider that a waste of time? Do you have to be running, 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 doing, doing, doing? Well, guess what? Stillness, silence, quietude, calmness, centering, they're all effective uses of time. They actually increase your effectiveness, your productivity, your efficiency, drive, stamina, motivation, and ambition. After you've calmed down and gotten quiet, you may find even more tenacity and vigor and vitality and pep, get up and go, than when you're frazzled and out of sorts and running yourself frantic to the ground. Just like listening is an action verb, it takes skill and talent and concentration. It takes commitment and single-mindedness and verve to be still. Even to listen. Listening is an action. Actively, compassionately, and non-judgmentally listening is the greatest gift you can give some. It's certainly an action. It's a verb. Even though you're not saying anything or doing anything, you're just listening. That's a clear example of how a seemingly innate action can have more mileage than if you were running a marathon. And it's the same when you're talking, talking, talking. We always put our foot in our mouth when we're talking. Maybe practicing silence is the best use of time. Silence is golden. It's an opportunity to receive valuable messages and insights. You can't put a price on reaching your soul and spirit. So many people are uncomfortable with silence and stillness. They have to be talking or doing. Yet being silent with a partner or lover, that's the most potent form of connection and intimacy. Many people tell me they don't know what to do after they've been on several dates because they have nothing to say. They've already shared who they are, all their past, all their likes and dislikes, and they just are so uncomfortable because there's silence between them. And I say, wow, what a blessing to be able to be silent with someone else. Oh, that shows, wow, how much you guys care about each other and how much you're really comfortable with each other. That's the best sign of warm, cozy comfort is if you can be silent with another person. Non-action, it can be as powerful as non-verbal communication. We know how looks and stares, sneers and smiles can be so compelling, convincing, forceful, vivid and dramatic and moving, and you're not even speaking a word. Non-verbal communications say so much more than talky. Consider how captivating silence is in music or acting in a play or a film. It's the moments without dialogue that are penetrating and impactful and profound. It's the silence that is golden and worth $1 million. In music, oh my gosh, the silence that makes the music. You might not notice it, but it's the silence that is so commanding in music, even in movies. I mean, think about it. That's when the message is so penetrating and profound, during the silence. Similarly, meditating can just be as vigorous, vital, and active as jogging several miles or completing other tasks. In fact, many companies are now requiring their employees to meditate on a daily basis as part of their work routine. I know one organization where it's mandatory that they meditate before they even convene for a meeting, no matter where they are in the world. Before they discuss their daily mission, they have to meditate. And these people have found that they're much more centered and focused after everyone meditates as a group. What a great use of time. If you meditate beforehand, you can accomplish much more in less time. In the same vein, sleeping is crucial to managing your time, because if you're not rested, you won't be as energized, as available, or bursting with the creativity that you crave. Even though sleeping might seem like it's a waste of time for all you night owls out there, it's essential to be your best self. And are you afraid to say no? Do you know how to say no? Are you worried you might be left out if you say no or miss an event? Learning to say no is absolutely critical to time management. Remember, your time is a valuable property. It's worth more than all the money in the world. If you want to use it wisely, you will learn to say no to others and yes to yourself. There's a huge epidemic of people-pleasing in the world. Most people are suffering from the onslaught and effects of the terror of saying no and setting boundaries. Everyone wants to be liked to the point that they're willing to give up their integrity, their honor, their precious time. They will allow people to walk all over them just to be liked, especially when it's regarding loved ones. I've heard stories of caregivers who are so focused on taking care of someone else to their detriment They don't even have their teeth cleaned. They don't take showers, wash their hair, exercise or eat properly or sleep enough. And is that really being there for the other person? No way, Jose. Your welfare, well-being, spiritual, physical, mental, and emotional health is adamant before you can be there for others. You have to put yourself first. And contrary to what I was taught, that doesn't mean you're conceited. This is urgent. It's pressing. This is high priority. It's life or death. It's of the utmost importance to put yourself first. Trust me, if you don't, no one else in your life will benefit. You won't be able to really be there for them, and they will know it. You're actually hurting other people when you don't make yourself high priority, putting that oxygen mask on yourself first. Beware if being of service is something that you desire and it makes you feel spiritually fit. As Winston Churchill said, we make a living by what we get, but we make a life by what we give. That's great and altruistic, but again, you have to put the oxygen mask on yourself first. How do you learn to say no? Practice, practice, practice. At first, it's going to be awkward. You can write out what you're going to say. Remember that people will be so used to you being a yes person that they'll rebel, put up a fuss, have a hissy fit or a temper tantrum. Their reaction is none of your business, just like what they think of you is none of your business. I was talking to a friend the other day, and I really admired how she said no to me. I invited her to an event, and she said to me, I'm really trying to manage my time and only do things that I'm really passionate about. Wow, I was taken aback. She has become my new heroine. And she used to party her life away. So I was super impressed. Wow. To anything, turn, 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 there is a time. And that can be right now for you, right this minute. You don't have to wait a second more to stop wasting time. Whoops, that second's already gone, never to return. Quick as a flash. It's really about deserving and receiving the gifts the universe has to offer, starting with your time. You don't owe anyone anything, let alone your time. Would you give up your left arm to someone or your right foot? Well, then why give up your time? I wish I was taught that in school. Time management. Wow, can you imagine what the world would be like if we were taught that we deserve to spend our time on things we're passionate about, that we can say no to others and yes to ourselves, in fact, that it's urgent and vital that we say no to others, that that's a high priority? What a concept. I was taught the complete opposite in my family, in school, in my community. I was taught you have to do this, you have to do this, you owe me, you owe me. No wonder everybody's developed entitlement. People are so angry, feeling used and abused by others, they want payback. They think the universe owes them and they're going to make everyone else suffer. They feel like they're owed because they gave up so much. They gave up their time. Well, time is on your side. I reiterate that forgiveness and compassion will heal the entitlement epidemic and cure it. It starts with forgiving yourself. Forgiving yourself for allowing others to manipulate, control, use, abuse you and your time. And then forgive yourself for abusing yourself and abusing your time. And then have compassion for that part of yourself that's been abused and that has been abandoned and treated without honor or respect. Forgive yourself for using and abusing your time, because right now that is in the past. That was then and this is now. You are no longer abusing your time because you are learning to say no to others and yes to yourself. And you can also forgive others for controlling you, manipulating you, and have compassion for them, because chances are that on the inside, they're manipulating, abusing, and controlling because they don't feel too good about themselves. It's never about the outside. It's about the inside. It's the inners that matter, not the outers. people who are suffering, they're the same as us. They may express it differently. They may act out their suffering in a different way. But if you can just have compassion for them, you can not only heal their suffering, their mistreatment, their angst and entitlement, but you can heal yourself at the same time. It's when people feel alone, that no one gets them, that no one understands, the disease, the dysfunction, the anger, the hate, the hostility grows, develops, feeds, and festers. Think about it. Have you ever considered giving someone a hug who's raging and having a moment? I'm not saying go into the lion's den when a rageaholic is in full-blown attack, but my favorite recollection is from the movie Hook. One of the Lost Boys says about a pirate who's gone off the deep end, "He needs a mommy real bad." And isn't that true of all of us? Aren't we looking for a mommy or daddy, someone to love us unconditionally, or the dream of a mommy or daddy, since many of us didn't have that experience? And that's why it's so hard for most people to trust, because they didn't have a role model. Even if the love is there, maybe they were too damaged to accept it, sort of like Groucho Marx. I wouldn't be a member of any club that would have me. That's been my MO. I was so broken that if anyone loved me, I questioned their motive and intent. I had no experience of unconditional love. They say wounded healers make the best healers. I'm definitely falling into that category. A pediatrician used to say to me, "How come you're such an incredibly loving and nurturing mom?" Because he knew what kind of childhood I grew up in. Well, I think it's instinctual. I was always the one unconditionally loving in my family. I just didn't get it in return. In fact, I went out of my way to do whatever I thought would bring peace, even to my own detriment. No wonder I stopped breathing so often as a child and developed asthma. I was choking because I had no say. I was never heard. I just gave up and got sick. I kept giving and giving until there was nothing left of me, not even my breath. I carried that into my adulthood, getting drained, putting everyone first, never saying no. I remember I would say yes to several people in one Saturday night, and then I would try my darnest to make it to all the events, yet never really being able to revel in any of them. I did the same with friendships. I thought I had to please everyone in order for them to like me, and I was so busy being a chameleon, I didn't get to discover who I was or what I liked. I really imagined that I would be content if you were content. Again, I used my family as the barometer, but as with them, nothing I did would ever make them happy. I would never get their approval. And that's the biggest life lesson. No matter what I say or do or don't say or don't do, I will get someone's approval only if it's meant to be. As in love, if I'm supposed to be with that person, I will be no matter what I say or don't say or do or don't do. And vice versa, if I'm not supposed to be with that person, no matter what I say or don't do, I won't be. So I am free to say no. No, thank you. No is a complete sentence. I can use that when I'm setting boundaries with someone else. I spoke with a friend recently about a man she's dating, and she kept saying, "But he'll get mad, but he won't like it. But he said I can't do this," or he said, but he. She's a wonderfully loving soul, which most codependents are. I basically suggested to her. And by the way, she did call for my advice, so I wasn't offering it and trying to play God, which just goes to show you that I actually do practice what I preach. Anyway, I suggested maybe taking "but he" out of her vocabulary, and I tried to guide our conversation away from him and towards her. And finally, we got down to the nitty-gritty that it wasn't about him, but he won't like it, but he'll get mad if I say no. It was about her having a hard time saying no. It's never about the other person, especially when we're pointing the finger at them. Three are pointed back at us, which indicates it's our mishigas, and that takes a lot of chutzpah, because most of us don't want to look at ourselves. It's easy to blame others, play the victim, and point, point, point. So I did tell this wonderful woman that this could be an opportunity for her to practice setting boundaries. And it doesn't matter if he or she is the one that you're in a relationship with. It doesn't matter that you're going to be together forever or not. The challenge is to work on your own issues while that person is in your life, because they're in your life for a reason. Everyone is a mirror. People are placed in our lives as lessons or gifts, and usually both. Everyone's a reflection so we can see ourselves and what we need to work on. My favorite concept is that the thing that bothers you most about the other person is the very thing you have to work on. And if you want to move to a higher level, become enlightened, aware, and conscious, and the best version of yourself, then you will use that as a tool and welcome that other person in your life. It's not always where it's hunky-dory. And if there's someone in the room that bothers you the most, that's the person that's going to be your biggest gift and your biggest lesson. Well, by the end of my phone call with my friend, she realized she had to work on setting boundaries without worrying about what he might think, and that she does have rights, that she deserves to say no, that she can take control and get out of the victim mentality. And that's my wish for you for this new year, to manage your time and learn to say no. We were talking about the issue that this gentleman was demanding that they talk on the phone for a long time in the evenings. That didn't always work for her. You know that drill, folks. When you don't want to pick up the phone and you see who's calling and you know they're going to take up your time and melt your ear away. And same with my friend. Her hesitation was that this gentleman likes to talk for hours and she gets tired at night, which is a great opportunity to set a boundary on the phone. That's how you can begin taking charge of your time. Notice your phone time, your email time, your texting time. You can control the length of your conversations and refrain from refusing to pick up the phone. You don't have to do that anymore. Everyone has done that before. You see who's on the line and you say, I better not pick up because I know this person's going to gab for hours. And I must confess, I've done that. But you no longer have to communicate solely by text for fear of that scenario. That's why so many people will only text. They won't talk to you on the phone. One of the reasons is because they've lost the ability to communicate verbally on the phone. Everybody's so used to emailing and texting. But the other reason is because no one knows how to set boundaries and say, I have to get off the phone right now, or I can't talk right now, or this isn't a good time. You won't even have to avoid difficult people anymore because you'll know that you can say no and stop at any point. I always do this. When I call someone on the phone, I say, is this a good time? Because I want to give them the opportunity to say no. And that's something you can practice. And when you start practicing that with other people, hopefully they'll return the gift in kind and ask you, is this a good time to talk? When you learn to say no on phone calls or in person, you won't have to listen to criticism, abuse, and hot-headedness and hostility, because you'll be able to say, I'm going to get off the phone now. I'll talk to you at a later time. In fact, if you do talk to someone who pushes your buttons, you can put a timer on before you even start the conversation. I know that with certain family members, civility will last just for a few minutes, but past that time, it almost always moves from light to dark, from polite to angry and judgmental. So I use the timer and I limit the conversation. And you know what? It works, because we get off the phone hunky-dory. Contemplate these time management tips when you're talking on the phone. You can say, I'd love to talk with you. I've only got 5 or 10 minutes to talk. You can also do something while you're conversing. You can multitask and then talk as long as it's proficient for you with whatever job, chore, or endeavor that you've undertaken while you're on the phone. The next tool you can use is to foreshadow. When it's 3 minutes before that time period is up, you can say, I've only got 3 minutes left. Is there anything else you'd like to discuss before we wrap it up? Thirdly, when there's 1 minute left, you can say, "It was good to talk to you. Thank you for calling and have a blessed night." And it's really, really, really important that you follow through. You don't want to say, "Hi, I just want to let you know I have 10 minutes to talk," and then go on and on ad infinitum. Can you imagine if everybody practiced this? Maybe there'd be a lot more direct communication on the phone. Oh, it would be so lovely if everyone would follow these simple steps. There'd be a lot less avoidance, avoidance, avoidance. I'm so sick of meeting people or talking to people only online or by texting or by emailing. And then when I try to have a conversation or call someone, they are flustered. They can't even speak. No words come out of their mouth. They've lost the ability to form a sentence. It's no surprise that those who abhor saying no will only text so they can keep it short and sweet. But guess what? You can keep it short and sweet and practice this even on a date or at dinner, at parties, at business or family functions or social events. Decide how much time is good for you and then stick to it. That's what's imperative. That's the key. It's integral and requisite to setting boundaries. You've got to follow through no matter what. Even if the other person is throwing a tizzy or huffing and puffing, that's not your problem. You don't have to make their problem your problem. Stay focused on setting your boundary. That's the loving act. That's the esteemable act. You're doing it as a gift you give to yourself. It doesn't matter how the other person takes it. The win, the victory is that you stuck to your guns. It will get easier and easier, and no will become a complete sentence. As a matter of fact, no will become easier than saying yes, yes, yes. And you'll be able to go to functions because you won't have to stay and be the last person. You won't have to close down the place. You'll be able to leave when you're comfortable and when it's good for you so that you can control your time. That's the greatest resolution you can give to yourself. Check it out. You'll be saving civilization and the planet. Because when you find that peace within, when you're honoring and respectful to yourself, then you can honor and respect others. You can be healing yourself and the world simultaneously, preventing war and the earth's demise. I would be remiss if I didn't segue to how perfectionism and procrastination affect time management. How often do you procrastinate due to those age-old negative messages you feed your body, mind, and spirit, like, "I'll never succeed anyway, so why bother? And even if I begin something, then I'll have to be subject to other people's criticism and I won't be able to handle that. So better if I just stay hidden and invisible." Perfectionists procrastinate because they have such a high expectation of themselves and others. If they don't think they can do something in their eyes perfectly, they won't attempt it. Well, the cure for perfectionism is to realize doing your best, your personal best, that's what matters. You're perfect just the way you are. I try to take that word out of my vocabulary, and it helps. Perfectionism is a figment of your imagination. It doesn't exist. There's no such thing. Some people procrastinate because they have low self-worth, and they say to themselves, "I'm sure I'll fail. I'm not capable, so why try?" Some are so afraid of other people's opinions, of possible rejection, making a mistake, they won't even take a risk. That fear keeps them frozen and stuck in a rut of procrastination. Those who are frantic and believe they have to accomplish a zillion things each day might become so overwhelmed and frazzled they're drowning under a pile of to-do lists. They're convinced they're responsible for everyone and everything. They're so buried in chaos, they can't see how to manage time. They haven't ascertained that they're enough or that they have enough time. Don't say you don't have enough time. You have exactly the same number of hours per day that were given to Helen Keller, Louis Pasteur, Michelangelo, Mother Teresa, Leonardo da Vinci, Thomas Jefferson, and Albert Einstein. And that's a quote from H. Jackson Brown Jr. There's that difference of perspective regarding time. My favorite is on Venus compared to Mars. A lot of men will say, "I just saw you. I just talked to you the other day, even though it's been a week." And this woman will say to him, "I haven't talked to you in forever, even though it's been 4 hours," because on Venus, 4 hours can be eternity. if they don't hear from their lover. Here's some additional helpful hints to take advantage of your precious seconds and hours. Be curious. Be open to opportunity. Know yourself. Embrace your passions. Enjoy what you're doing. Accentuate the positive. Stay in the now. Prioritize what's valuable to you. Remain focused on your goals, your ambitions, and your values. Discern whether the company you keep lifts you up or brings you down, supports you or holds you back, encourages you or makes you feel incompetent and unworthy. And then choose wisely who you spend your time with. Always put self-care on the top of your list. And remember, curiosity, courage, creativity is all you need to succeed. You already have those inside of you. Deep in the confines, the innermost sanctums of your existence, you don't have to go out there to find them. You don't have to get them from somewhere else. That will save you a lot of time because you don't have to go out looking, looking, looking. They're already waiting inside of you to be discovered. Let go of the past and the future. That's the best use of your time ever. Savor and relish this minute. Appreciate what you have and who you are. Celebrate the moment. Rejoice in the now. Life's greatest gift, which is why they call it the present. And I'm eternally grateful for this miraculous, magnificent, marvelous moment that I've gotten to spend with you. You light up my life and bring me hope to carry on. And now it's time for our caller. Hello there. Welcome to Sleepless in Studio City. I'm Dr. Debs, and who am I speaking with?
Richard Young.
Hi, Richard, and where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Monrovia, California.
Well, welcome to the show, and what's on your mind tonight? What's keeping you from sweet, soft slumber?
Well, the main thing is I have a big light show coming up. I do those old vintage 1960s liquid light shows, and the band is the original Strawberry Alarm Clock that had the hit song Incense and Peppermints back in 1967. And this will be our fourth show with the Strawberry Alarm Clock, and we're doing this in conjunction with the Midnight Sunlight Show, who is actually the official light show for the Strawberry Alarm Clock.
Did you get to meet George Benell?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah, I went to a couple of their rehearsals, and yeah. I mean, Robert Jacobs, who runs the Midnight Sunlight Show and also manages the Strawberry Alarm Clock, you know, he took me to a couple of their rehearsals. And like I said, this will be our fourth show with them. We did two in Burbank at Studio 601, which was a great venue. All the walls were white, perfect to project on. And we had four projectors on liquids and four projectors on patterns.
Wow.
Robert had a couple of 16-millimeter projectors and a big video projector, so it was a big show, and we did that twice. One of them was, if I remember correctly, it was a record release party, and the other one was Mark Weiss, who is the keyboard player. It was his 70th birthday, so it was a big birthday party at the same venue.
Wow. You're actually making money doing what you love.
Yes.
That's so great. And that's so rare because most people are just working at a job and they don't even enjoy it. And you get to pursue your craft.
Every job I have had, I have loved because it's had something to do with the industry. It's had something to do with music. It's had something to do with audio. It's had something to do with video, visual, lighting, you name it.
You've been able to support yourself the whole time in your art with your craft.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, that's good to know. So everybody listening out there can know that they can actually do what they love and make money at it. Because you know how most people will give up their craft. Or they'll be told by society, oh, don't do that. You'll never make money. Like I was told as a kid, you're not going to make money playing the piano or singing or performing. You have to go to school and be a lawyer or a doctor or a business person or a CPA.
I got all that crap from my dad.
Oh, you did?
I got that crap from my dad. Yeah, you'll never make any money. Yeah, you'll never wind up to be a hill of beans, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, you're going to wind up like your Uncle Pete.
How did you get the courage to disobey him?
What I did was my second job, I worked for Litton Industries, which at that time was Sweda cash registers, mechanical cash registers, and Monroe calculating machines, which were mechanical calculators. In fact, one of my areas was JPL. I spent probably almost a month every day at JPL doing preventive maintenance on all of their calculators. I got to go in the control room and see the moon landing. I got to see a lot of stuff long before it was ever released to the public. I was watching on closed circuit TV straight from the spaceship. Yeah. So.
Wow. That sounds so exciting, and you sound like a real go-getter. Are you still pursuing other crafts and creativity?
Yeah, I do a couple of things. But you know, what you were asking me how I disobeyed my dad, and what happened was when I got my first paycheck from Monroe, I went in. He was sitting down on the couch, and you know, at the coffee table in the den. And I walked in and I slapped my paycheck on the table and I said, I hope this pays for my rent. Well, my dad had never mentioned anything about rent, but I knew it would be coming because I was working and, you know, I was making money. And so I was sure that my dad was going to somewhere down the line tell me that I owed him X amount of dollars for rent.
Right.
So I slapped the paycheck on the table and I said, here, I hope that covers me for a month's rent. And he picked it up and looked at it, and he said, this is $140. He said, that's more than what I expected for rent.
Aww.
And I said, okay, so we're good. And he goes, yeah. He said, what was this, 2 weeks' pay? And I said, no, Dad, that was a week's pay. and my dad said, you're making more money than I am. And I looked him square in the eyes, and I said, and I will always, always make more money than you do. Yeah. And it happened. It happened. So my dad basically had to shut his frickin' mouth because I showed him that I could make money doing things that I love to do.
And you know? I bet he's a proud dad now.
Probably.
Are you a dad now?
Well, yeah. I have three sons.
I was wondering if you were the type of dad your dad was, or if you're the type of dad that says, go out there and pursue your creativity, and it doesn't matter.
That was basically what I said. Now, see, my mom was just the opposite from my dad. My mom, God bless her, you know, her thing to me was, you can be anything. You can do anything you want as long as you set your mind to it and set your heart to it.
Wow.
You can do it. That was my mother.
Oh, and wow. You had a real, that was a real supporting.
She was so supportive. When I went to work for KRLA doing their Pasadena Civic Auditorium Saturday night thing, KRLA and the Seeds and the Wizard Light Show. Well, I was their house light show. But my partner at that time and I had just split up a week before, and so I gave them half the equipment. I took the other half of the equipment. I was at Lex Diamond's house, and Lex was the ad manager for radio station KRLA back in the day. This is 1967. And so he said that the radio station was going to start doing concerts at the Pasadena Civic Auditorium. And he asked me if I would like to be the house light show. And I said, absolutely. So I went to my mom and I went, help! You know, because my ex-partner, Kip Gates, you know, had half my equipment and I really needed much more anyway. So what my mom did was she took all of her diamonds, her rings, her brooches, her bracelets, everything, pawned all of her diamonds and handed me $3,200 cash. In 1967.
Are you serious? So that you could do that?
I am dead serious.
Oh my gosh, I have chills running up my spine. That is amazing. Oh, I am so touched by that.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
No wonder, Richard, you have been able to continue to pursue this because you had that support. And that's why I was asking if you're a dad, and if you are, if you have broken the cycle of how your dad was and passed on how your mom was.
My son, we're setting up stages, moving microphones around, and actually mixing concerts. Chris was 13 years old when he mixed his first concert. And I'm not talking about just a little three-piece band. I'm talking about a seven-member band. You know, a couple of guitars, keyboards, bass, drums, vocals, all that kind of stuff. I taught him how to mix on a mixing board. And he was just fabulous. He's had a great set of ears. All three of my kids were musicians. I kind of, you know, gave them nudge for that. Chris played trumpet. Morgan played sax. Ian started out before any of them playing piano, and then he graduated to Hammond organ. And
you could have a family band with
we did that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they joined me on stage several times. It started out with Ian. I had a band called the Motherboard Blues Band. We jokingly called it MBBB. And our lead singer, John, had quit the band about 2 weeks before the Downey Street Fair. They were hurting for talent. It was sponsored by Supervisor Don Canopy, who is now, of course, termed out. But anyway, he sponsored it, which meant that, you know, the county sponsored it, which meant that ISD, Internal Services Department, where I worked, provided the sound system. And so Christopher and, well, actually all three of them came down. And I taught Christopher how to set up a stage, and Morgan and Ian. And Christopher mixed his first concert at the Downey Street Fair when he was 13 years old.
Wow. Are they still all pursuing the arts in some form?
No.
Oh, no?
The only one that is Ian, my youngest one. He started out playing piano. About 4 years later, he graduated to Hammond organ, which is what I play. He took Hammond organ lessons from a rock and roll Hammond organ player from the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he just did it. I mean, he can wax me on the organ. I mean, he's much better than I am.
And is he making a living playing the organ?
No. He's actually making a living doing videos and network maintenance for a company that does animation for cartoons, which is his love. That's what he wanted to do, and that's what he's doing.
And your other sons?
They're in the communications field, which is what they both wanted to do. So, you know, I nudged them along in the right direction, and they turned out to be very successful. You know, financially, you know, Christopher is much more successful than I ever was. I mean, he's pulling down six figures. I never made that kind of money.
Well, that's so wonderful, and they're so lucky to have a parent that supports them that way. So you actually raised your sons?
Yes, I did. I did. I was a single father.
And how was that?
It was great, because we had family traditions, and the big one that we did every year was a haunted house. And we did that for 11 years. It was the biggest haunted house around. In fact, AOL, America Online, actually sent a representative around to various cities to check out haunted houses. We were rated by AOL the number one haunted house in the entire state of California.
Oh, my gosh. I'm sorry. I missed it. Well, maybe I didn't miss it. What city was it in? I used to do that. That's a tradition with my daughter, as a matter of fact. But my favorite ones are the ones that are at houses. There used to be one near me. Somebody worked at the studios in special effects. So every year, you probably had a similar thing. Every year, they literally had like holograms and better than what they had at Universal or Disneyland or Knott's Berry. It was just amazing. Yeah. People would line up. Did people line up around the block to come and see your haunted house?
The last year that we did it, we had over 1,000 people.
Oh.
And these are just, you know, keep in mind, these are just trick-or-treaters. These are just people that were out walking.
Oh, I know. I was probably there. That's so great to have the traditions. How lucky your kids to have a father like you. And do they have kids?
No.
Have kids? I was going to say, hopefully when they do, they will be a similar parent as you and pass on the love and the nurturing. And well, speaking of love and nurturing, how do you give that to yourself these days?
I surround myself with creative people, musicians, singers, artists, visual artists, sculptor, you know, anything to do with the arts, you know, and that runs the gamut. That goes from plays, you know, to the movies, to sound effects, to everything that has to do with the arts. And I surround myself with those kind of people. So it's very nurturing. And, you know, now that psychedelic light shows are making a comeback and the revival, and there's a lot of little tiny piddly-ass, you know, psychedelic light shows, well, they're all coming to me. Because I'm still doing it 52 years later. And so I'm mentoring some of these younger people. My partner is 23 years old.
Oh.
And that's Andrew, and he runs a light show called Stranger Liquids. And, you know, and we collaborate a lot. You know, he drags me along to his shows, and I drag him along to mine. And, And, you know, he's just very grateful. Then I've got a young lady back in Nashville, Anna, who has a light show. Her and her husband have a light show. And I send them care packages about once a month. I send them, you know, dyed mineral oil, or I send them patterns or whatever.
So it sounds like you have a lot of support and nurturing and have continued what your mom started many years ago when you were born. And have people in your life that are supportive.
I just give it away. You know, I mean, what I've got is some God-given talent to do all of these things, to know about audio, to know how to mix a band, you know, to know how to do stage lighting, to know how to do psychedelic light shows. I have an enormous Christmas light collection. I've been collecting Christmas lights since I was 13.
Wow.
And I'm sitting on my front porch now looking at this big, huge wreath on my door that's got about 20 bubble lights, 20 vintage bubble lights from the 60s. My house is lit up with sign lamps, big sign lamps like they use at Altadena Christmas Tree Lane. And that, I've done the tree lighting ceremony for that ever since 1990. And that's a 1 mile of Theodore's that they've been lighting.
I think I've heard about that.
It's a historic landmark.
Right.
It's the oldest Christmas tree lane in America.
Have you heard of Hastings Ranch?
Absolutely. Used to go through there a lot when I was a kid, back in the days when people would really get into it. They'd have animated displays, you know, Ferris wheels that moved and all that kind of stuff. I did all that.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I'm going to take a brief station break for a magical musical interlude, and we'll be right back, so hold that thought. And now, the moment you've been waiting for, our magical musical interlude featuring the stunning singer, writer, and arranger, Gina Kronstadt. She's going to be performing an original tune called Magic from her CD entitled Come Over. Come Over has been described as sheer poetry, stemming from Gina's totally unique and exquisite blend of vocals, melody, lyric, arrangement, and production. Never was musical genius so fun, tasty, and addictive. Some of these tracks I've replayed 100 times. Love it. Come Over. And that was from Sandra Singh Loh. She's an NPR radio personality, author, and performer. Another reviewer said about the CD Come Over, "Musically, it rolls like a true culmination of Kronstadt's many years of experience in the music biz, with jazz overtones and undertones throughout a set, driven by true pop soul sensibilities." And for those few people who are not yet familiar with the virtuosity and versatility of sax and woodwind master Bob Shepherd, the playful, crisply swinging opening track called Magic is a great way to both hear Bob Shepherd at his best and experience his impact on Kronstadt through her lyrical tribute. And that's what we're going to hear, the opening track, Magic. John Beasley is on Rhodes, Christian McBride on upright bass, Gary Novak on drums, Louis Conte on percussion. Wow, I'm getting chills up my spine. And Bob Shepherd on sax and a string section led by Joel Drouin. That is la creme de la creme of jazz musicians. So stay tuned for that. You don't want to miss Gina Kronstadt. She's been a session violinist for many years, playing on records, Michael Jackson, Earth, Wind, and Fire, Kelly Clarkson, Beyonce, Michael Bublé, on TV, Mad Men, Mozart in the Jungle, American Idol, The Voice, in film, Godfather, Jurassic World, Bridge of Spies, Star Trek Beyond, etc. but she's also been singing and songwriting since she was 18 years old. And now Gina has two CDs out and a single. She's played gigs around town for a few years, and now she's decided she wants to share the bill and promote girl power. And it's rare, she said, to find women who sing, write, and arrange at this level. She is so excited to be performing with these three talents who you've heard on the show before, Susan Martyr and Katina De Luna. These three ladies will be performing on February 1st at Vitello's in Studio City, backed by an all-star band at the top of their game, Rich Ruttenberg on piano, Edwin Livingston on bass, Joel Taylor drums, Brian Schwartz trumpet, Tom Luer sax, Peter Kent violin, Roche O'Marin on violin, Rodney Wartz viola, and Peggy Baldwin on cello. Don't miss this show. You will experience expert, superb talent in an up-close and personal, intimate listening room. Who can ask for anything more? I can't wait for this show. Gina said that although Katina, Susan, and her have very different styles and backgrounds, it's such a joy to work and be inspired by such amazing talent, and somehow it all works. She said, I think we all just look so forward to the nights we get to get on that stage with an all-star band and perform our music and really give ourselves to the audience. It's the best. I asked Gina what music means to her, and she said, singing, writing, and arrangement means everything to me. It's a major way I express who Gina is. I've never written for others, for radio, etc. I just write what I'm inspired to write, and the icing on the cake is if people embrace it. Any way to honestly express who I am, I'm all for. Well, hallelujah, and ditto to that, Gina. I'm all for being who you are and expressing it through your creativity. They say that that's the source of reaching your soul and spirit. Some people call it reaching God inside of them through their creativity. And it sounds like you've done that very thing. And I asked Gina what inspired her to write the song Magic that we're gonna hear. She said, I love that question. We aren't asked that often enough about our songs. She said, Magic is actually written about Bob Shepherd, how his playing has moved and inspired me over the decades that I've known him. Oh, and I can't wait for you to hear that tune. I've also been inspired by Bob Shepherd. As a matter of fact, he performed just recently at the Oyster House in Studio City, right across the street from us. What a treasure and gem he is to the jazz world. Then I asked Gina what she thought was the key to finding and keeping love. She said it's to honor and respect anything and everything that you love. Everything takes work and dedication. I asked Gina what her advice to aspiring artists was, and she said to work hard, to listen to a lot of different styles of music, to stay open to your unique voice and not to let others tell you what to do. Gina said, I took theory and composition classes in college. One class being from Frank Zappa when he was a visiting faculty member. She still remembers his key piece of advice. There's no such thing as a wrong note. And other visiting faculty members there were Joni Mitchell, Clark Terry, and Jean-Luc Ponte. Gina said from there, she ran with all that information to find her own personal voice as a singer, writer, and arranger. Gina said, I suggest to others that whatever your passion is, dive in. Expect bumps along the way and learn from them, but dive in. I love it. Thank you, Gina. I'm ready to dive in. In fact, that sounds like a good title for a song. Dive In. I think I'm going to use that. You've inspired me already. Thank you, Gina, for being so forthcoming. Without further ado, here's the amazing, incredible, incomparable Gina Kronstadt performing the original tune, Magic.
Thrill me, kill me with your beauty, never let it go. Just keep doing what you're doing, putting on a show.
Great was that, and welcome back, Richard. And we were talking about how you keep yourself surrounded by nurturing, supportive people in the creative field. You mentioned when you first called that what was keeping you awake was a show that's coming up. And
right.
So I was wondering, what kind of things do you do to relax yourself and to be calm when you have a big show coming up so that you don't lose sleep?
I meditate. You know, I meditate, I close my eyes and sit in a quiet position and with no distractions around, nobody home, you know, and I do that. And sometimes I just do, you know, physical activities. I take my dog for a walk, you know, and I like to drive. So sometimes I just go for a drive with no place in mind to go. I just go for a drive. I read a lot.
Uh-huh.
I'll listen to music, you know.
Oh, music helps you relax.
I'll listen to, I mean, I'm a fan of all music. I mean, I even have done shows with rap artists. My view on the history of rap is what happened was all the school districts quit funding creative programs like theater, like music, you know, and so a lot of schools, especially the high schools, did not have music programs. And so what happened is you got all these creative type people that didn't have musical instruments, that didn't have any musical training, so that they would basically, for lack of a better term, they would steal guitar riffs off of a certain song and they'd loop it and then they'd rap along to it or whatever. So that is my take on how rap got started.
I like that concept. No, that totally makes sense because I remember when they stopped having music and funding it, and I was talking to someone about that the other day, and I was talking about how creativity is a great way to get in touch with everybody's inner spirit and strength and soul, and that people aren't doing that anymore in schools, and there's just a lot of people who are angry and hostile and are treating each other really badly because they don't have an outlet for their creativity, and we've got to get that back into the schools so people can connect that way. It sounds like you've gone down in history, that you've done a lot of historic things and doing more now coming up. Your life is so fulfilled as a parent and with your creativity and your art. What about love in your life? Is there anyone that you're having a romantic relationship with in that area? How's that going?
I wish for it. I'm actually on one dating site. It's a free dating site. It's called Plenty of Fish. POF.com, and I'm there, and
how has that been working?
it's been interesting, to say the least.
Have you been on for a while, or are you a new...
I've been on for about 3 months.
Newly.
Yeah, yeah, and I've only been on two dates, and actually, one of them wasn't a date. The first one was a date. It was a coffee date. It lasted a little bit less than an hour, and then she left, and I sent her a text message and said, hey, you know, that was nice to meet you. You want to get together again? Well, I never heard back, and so a couple of days later, I called her and basically said the same thing on her voicemail, and she never returned my call. So I figured, okay, I'm not what she was looking for.
What did you do before the 3 months as far as your romantic?
Well, I was in a relationship, but it wasn't a very good relationship.
And how long did that last?
7 years.
Okay, that's a long time.
Yeah.
It wasn't good the whole time?
If I was to put it in a calculator, I would say maybe 50% of the time it was okay. Mm-hmm. It was never spectacular. It was never off the charts. But 50% of the time it was okay, and the other 50% of the time it was not.
And have you been in a relationship where it was more than 50% okay, where it was off the charts?
Yeah. you're probably going to think I'm a pervert, but probably the best and closest relationship I had was with a young lady that actually joined my band, the Motherboard Blues Band, as a backup singer. Mm-hmm. And we had three female backup singers, and she came in as an alto. And just kicked ass. She was a great singer.
And how long did that relationship last?
About 4.5 years. But the thing is, and the reason why I say you're going to probably think I'm a pervert, is when Jan and I got together, she was 18 years old. I was 48. So there was a 30-year gap between the two of us.
Okay, but you were both consenting adults, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and she was a great girl. I'm still in touch with her today. In fact, she came out and worked the light show with me for one of the Strawberry Alarm Clock performances that we did in Burbank.
So you're saying in that 4.5 years, it was at the top of the charts?
Sir? Yeah, for the most part.
Well, that's great that you had that. And what about the mother of your sons? How was that relationship? How long were you together?
8 years.
You were together 8 years?
Yeah.
And was any of that good? Was it 50%?
Yeah. I would say the first 2 years were really great. Mm-hmm. But then from that point on, it just went downhill, and it slowly went downhill until it imploded 8 years later, and then we got a divorce.
Since that, you've had another long-term one, 7 years and 4.5. Were there any other long-term relationships?
I long-distance dated a woman from South Lake Tahoe, a woman named Liz, who was just absolutely spectacular.
And how long was that one?
Well, we long-distance dated for 2.5 years, with her being in South Lake Tahoe and me being in Monrovia. I drove up there for the first time that we met, and that was, it was a 9-hour drive to get up there. But we just clicked, and we hit it right off.
So how did you meet the last, because you said the last one you were in was the 7-year relationship, and you said that it was only 50% okay, the one that you just broke up. But how did you guys meet?
We actually supposedly met on a dating site, but to this day we don't agree what dating site it was on. And I was only on one dating site, and this was, 9, 10 years ago. So she thinks it was one dating site. I think it was another.
Oh, but you both agree that it was some dating site.
Yeah, some dating site.
You've had luck on a dating site before.
Yeah. And right now, and I don't mean to sound egotistical, but the first day I got on Plenty of Fish, and I wrote a profile, and I put, a list of interests that I had, and blah, blah, blah. And the very next day, I had 12 emails from different women.
Oh, well, that's great. So have you connected with any of the 12? Well, you said you went out with two people. You've had two dates.
One of them is peeking through right now. This one that I've been wanting to talk to for months, she's calling right now.
So funny. What do you think is the key to finding and keeping love in your life? Because that's a question I always ask our musical artists.
You know what? I'm 69 years old, and I don't have all the answers. Because if I would, I wouldn't have had 3 failed marriages and a handful of shaky, flaky girlfriends along the way. I would still be in a relationship, and I'm not.
Right, but you know what they say about successes and failures, that it's not about just succeeding. It's the failures where we learn. And we learn from our mistakes, and we have lessons, and it's getting up one more time when you've been knocked down. I mean, that's the success.
Yeah.
So I can look at 3 failed relationships and say, you know what, but you had long-term relationships. So even if they failed, but you got lessons out of them, they're still a gift, and you still learn. So you probably have a lot more wisdom than you think in that area.
Well, the thing is, back in the 1800s, the average lifespan of a man was about 35 years, and the average lifespan of a woman was about 31 or 32 years, mainly because she died in childbirth, giving birth at home or something like that back in the Western days. But now, the life expectancy, my mom lived to be 94, and I'm 69. I hope I make it to my 90s. But what I've heard and what I've read and what I've experienced myself is not one relationship, but several, for lack of a better term, I would call it several serial monogamous relationships. In other words, I was in a relationship with this woman for X amount of years, and it was monogamous. I didn't, mess around with anybody else. It was just her. And then for whatever reason, that relationship dissolved, and somewhere down the line, I got into another relationship. So it's been a series of serial monogamous relationships. So that's what it's been. And each one has had a learning curve on it, because no two people are the same. I can't take, one woman and try and compare one woman to somebody that I'm dating and think in the back of my mind, my ex-wife did this and this and this, or you should do this and then that. But that's not the way it is. It's a learning curve. And with, the extended life expectancy of Americans, basically everybody around the world. I mean, some of the Chinese women live to be up in their hundreds. You know,
oh, yes.
Because they have such a great diet. You know,
because they're so healthy, and there's other reasons that there's people who are living longer, too, and a lot of it has to do not only with health, but handling stress and being with family and being with friends, the communities where people connect. There's one city that somebody was talking about, and the people live there a really, really long time, and it's because they all gather in the community and they have tea every day and they get together. This is how they spend their days. And it's a real community. It's not people isolated like it is in a city, because even though a city has thousands and thousands of people, it's so isolating. And it found that people live longer when they stay connected in a community environment and not only eat well, but commune.
I can believe that. I mean, you know, the Native American Indians of all the different tribes. In fact, I was in a relationship with a woman who was a Native American Indian from two tribes, I think Pueblo and Arapaho, I think, if I remember correctly. But at any rate, the Native American Indians traditionally live a lot longer than us, you know, Caucasian people, you know. And it's mainly because of what you just said, the fact that they have a community. I mean, they get together and they have a powwow and they have dances. They all perform traditional dances. Right. And it's the whole community that does it. It's not just, you know, four or five people out of a group of a couple of hundred. It's everybody participates.
Right.
So, you know, it's a communal type of a thing, you know.
Right.
I actually lived on a commune in 1969. I lived on the Hog Farm Commune in 1969 in Tahunga. And it was probably one of the best life experiences I've ever had. You know, because there were 72 people living on that commune, you know. And so you had to learn how to get along, and you had to learn, you know, that this person has that
work. It's
great.
I mean, communal living is absolutely wonderful. And it does, it adds years to your life. I've been there also, and it's a great experience. So what do you think, though, is the key to finding and keeping love in your life?
I think a lot of it is honesty. You have to be just brutal. I'm borrowing this from the 12-step program, but you have to be brutally honest with your mate. You know, you can't keep secrets. You can't hide things. You know, you have to be totally upfront. You have to be totally transparent to your mate. Mm-hmm. And your mate has to be the same way.
And you think, know? Is that the one key, or is there more that you think?
Oh, there's more than that. I think that's one, I think that's one at the top of the list.
Right.
You know, there has to be a shared passion, you know, shared sensuality and shared sexuality and, you know, just basic passion for life, you know, passion for living, and, you know, trying to get the most you can out of being on this third stone from the sun. You
right.
Know?
You know, right.
I think that's a lot of it. And, you know, and then friendship, you know, if what is a better thing than to fall in love with your best friend and your soulmate?
Especially for a man, that's the most important thing, is to be your best friend. I always tell women, because they say to me, oh my gosh, this guy or my husband or my lover, he keeps saying I'm his best friend and I don't want to be his friend. I don't want to be his friend. And I say to them, you don't understand, but for a man, if they say you're my best friend, that's the highest compliment that you will ever get from a man. Because women think, oh, that means you're like my buddy, you're my buddy. And no, so that's the highest compliment.
Everything else that goes along with it.
Right.
I mean, you know, I was guilty of this several times, and I've had several male friends that have been guilty of this. But if you build a relationship based on just sex, you've got a relationship that's built on a foundation of sand, and it's going to crumble. Going to fall apart, because you can't base a relationship on how good somebody is in bed. You know, it doesn't freaking matter. You know, what matters is that you know the person, that you're a best friend, that you're a comrade, that you're a confidant, that you're a partner in life, and
Right.
You know, and you know, out of all of that comes sensuality and sexuality, and you become great lovers and all of this kind of
right.
stuff. But if you don't have the other stuff, if you're not best friends, what have you got? You don't have shit.
Yeah.
But you don't have shit, you know?
I totally agree. On your honesty, when you were saying, you know, it's important to be honest. Funny that you said that, because I was just reading something from two people who have been married a really long time. And they were asked, what's the key to your relationship and having it work? And they said, well, it's not telling my partner, this was a husband and wife. It's not telling my partner everything, but keeping some things from them. Not that they're lying or anything, but just
yeah.
having like a separate life and just not sharing every single thing. And they didn't mean to be dishonest or to be secretive or to
right.
do things behind your back. So there's two different kinds of honesty. I have some friends that have been married forever. She always said to me, I don't take my mishigas to my husband. I take those things to my friends. And that's what is the key to keeping us together. Because
yeah.
I don't burden him with things that are overwhelming or that I can take to either a therapist
yeah.
or my support group or my buddies.
And I do both. I have a private therapist who I've seen. I hadn't seen her for probably 2 years, but I went and saw her 3 weeks ago, and I went and saw her 2 weeks ago, and I'm, you know, going to have another appointment probably in another several days. But yeah, you know, you can't sort out all your own problems. Sometimes you need an objective third party. You know,
right.
and a lot of times it isn't your mate. It's, you know, it's a therapist or it's a friend or something. You know, everybody's got skeletons in their closet. You know, if they're really, really bad skeletons, you probably are not going to tell your mate about it because, you know, it'd be horrible things that you did when you were younger or whatever.
Well, it sounds like you're doing a lot to be the best man that you can be, and I really appreciate
exactly.
that and admire that, and thank you so much for calling in. Just talking, though, about your three failed marriages, Sir Winston Churchill said, success consists of going from failure to failure without losing enthusiasm.
That's a pretty good expression. I like
and
that.
Actually, he's got a lot of words of wisdom. I thought that was a good one because we always think, oh gosh, I messed up or I had a failed marriage. I'll never have a successful one, so why bother? But really, the success is going from that failure to failure and still being enthusiastic. Yeah, I can still find love.
Right.
So I wish you luck in love and also in your light show. And I hope you have a wonderful sleep tonight.
I hope so too, and I probably will. So
well,
it's all good. It's
okay,
all good.
Well, enjoy, and thank you so much.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye, Richard.
Bye-bye.
We have a write-in question from Dylan in Atlanta. She says, I've been dating a guy for a few months who's really into me, but I just don't feel the same way. I appreciate his affections as it's been a long time since I had that kind of attention, but I don't want to lead him on, and I have to admit I enjoy his company. I just don't know if I can see myself with him for the long haul. Well, great question, Dylan. You're not alone in this dilemma. In fact, I've been there many times as well. I do know one thing, and that it's important that the man be more smitten than the woman for things to work. I'm sure you've heard this before. Maybe it's because women are more fickle on Venus and men on Mars are, well, it's more important that they're with a woman. In fact, when men aren't with someone, they tend to die earlier than women do. Well, Dylan, it sounds like this gentleman is a gift. I mean, you mentioned it's been a long time since you had that kind of attention. I would embrace it and revel in it. You deserve to be treated like a queen, and you don't owe him anything in return. And the other thing I recommend is to remember staying in the now. Don't worry about the future. You can just celebrate your time together. In fact, in order for any relationship to work, you have to stay in the now. That's why they call it the present, because it's a gift. And I found that when you stay in the now, everything is okay. All is well in the now. Everything's in perfect order right here and right now. But if you spend time in the past, you're going to be feeling regret, remorse, resentment. And if you're in the future, you're going to feel fear. You're going to worry and be anxious. So in the present, you're your best. And that's why relationships work when you spend time in the now. If you can just practice that, not worry about tomorrow, whether or not you're going to be together. Don't think about the past and how your past relationships have been or the future, but just experience the now. Take it in. Maybe this is your time, Dylan, to practice receiving. And that's a gift that you can give this gentleman, is to receive his affections, because that's going to make him feel good. Kind of a double whammy. You're receiving, he's allowed to give, and everybody can be a happy camper. And recognize that this guy is in your life for a reason. To everything, turn, turn, turn. If you weren't supposed to be with him, you wouldn't be. There's something to be gained here from both of you. You might not see that now, but trust that the universe is unfolding for the benefit of both of you. We are all mirrors for each other. You can use this opportunity to reflect off of him and look deep inside your soul. Perhaps it's a time to renew your self-worth, to go inside and heal the wounds or esteem issues or negative messages that you've been carrying around about yourself. That itself would be worth twice the price of tea in China. When you find yourself ruminating about the future, whether this is right or not, or mull over the fact you can't be there for him, just remember that it's happening because it's for your best and the good of all those that you care about. Whatever is happening right now, there's a reason for it. And this is what I always say. If you're not supposed to be together, whatever you say or don't do, you won't be together. And if you're supposed to be together, whatever you say or don't do, you will be together. For now, you're together for the best of both of you, or it wouldn't be happening. And just know there's nothing that you have to do or say right now in the here or now. Just enjoy this man's company. Enjoy who you are with him. Let yourself be your best and know that everything is in perfect order. I wish you the best of luck. Revel in the glory that is you and allow the universe to fill your bucket to the brim with love. Let this man love on you until you can love on yourself, so you can be there for others. And I leave you, Dylan, with these esteem builders. I take on new ventures with confidence. I am free to enjoy life without bondage to unrealistic expectations, and I have everything I need right here and right now. All is well, and so it is. Thank you for writing in. Good luck, Dylan.
That's all the time we have. We'd like to thank our exceptional crew. Frank Hernandez, Chief Engineering Officer, Lauren Rodriguez, Resident Photographer, Maxi Salters, Voiceover Extraordinaire, Shankari Scuvariona, and the Snoopy House. Tune in nightly at 9 p.m. Pacific Time and midnight Eastern Time to AmericanHeartsRadio.com for another enlightening episode of Sleepless in Studio City. Dr. Debs, deemed the new relationship guru, a West Coast Dr. Laura and an East Coast Carrie Bradshaw, provides soothing, heartfelt help. She will lift your spirits, illuminate your mind, inspire creativity, promote positivity, and empower you to pursue your highest aspirations. If you'd like to be a guest caller, featured artist, or have your write-in question answered on the show, feel free to contact Dr. Debs at sleeplessinstudiocity@gmail.com and she'll schedule you accordingly. For replay links, updates, and affirmations, please visit facebook.com/sleeplessinstudiocity or twitter.com/drdebs. Find full episodes on iTunes. You can also listen to 5-minute excerpts on YouTube while watching a soothing, serene slideshow. Dr. Debs is available round the clock for telephone life coaching sessions, and the first consultation is free. Contact her at sleeplessinstudiocity@gmail.com to arrange an appointment at your convenience. Dr. Debs will impart weekly wows, words of wisdom, and leave you with a weekly esteem builder to help you transform from the inside out. Repeat often. Say them in the morning, in the evening, while driving, standing in line, or on a lunch break. Speak with conviction, and you will begin to believe. Without further ado, here's Dr. Debs.
Thank you, Maxie, for that lovely closing. And I leave you with these words of wisdom. First from Helen Keller. She said, "Happiness cannot come from without. It must come from within. It is not what we see and touch or that which others do for us which makes us happy. It is that which we think and feel and do, first for the other fellow and then for ourselves." And you can use that to remember that the root of the Hebrew word for love, which is ohav, also means "I will give." And to truly love means to be concerned even more with the needs of the other than one's self. The agape definition of love, the highest form of love, means doing what's in the best interest of the other person, even if it means saying goodbye to them, or even if it means doing something that you might not agree with. And then I leave you with words of wisdom from Albert Schweitzer, who said, "Happiness is nothing more than good health and a bad memory." And that can be a recipe for a successful relationship, because it's really important that you forgive. And forgiving is forgetting. And that's true with any kind of relationship. Forgetting is a gift that enables us to move on from the mistakes of the past. And that has to do with mistakes that other people make or our own mistakes. People aren't perfect. We all make mistakes. But if we do something that we regret, or if we hurt another person, we can just apologize and move forward. We don't have to hold on to it. That's the blessing of forgetfulness. And then the last quote is from Mae West. And she said, "The most difficult years of marriage are those following the wedding." But truthfully, another piece of advice to remember in relationships is to compromise. There's no right way or wrong way, and it doesn't always have to be your way or the highway. I love when people say that their key to the relationship is the other person is always right. When there's been a long time relationship, the man will always say, "It's because she's always right, and I let her know she's always right." Or vice versa, when the woman says, "Well, he's always right, I let him be right," and then it works. And I've actually used that in relationship, and it does work. I've let go of having to win or having to be right. And when I do that, wow, my relationships blossom and bloom, and I feel 10 feet tall. So that's my blessing for you for this week. Remember, there's no right or wrong. You don't have to win. You're wonderful just the way you are. You can practice this affirmation when you stand in front of that mirror and say, "Hello, gorgeous. Hello, handsome. I'm lovable and valuable just the way I am. And what I adore, admire, and appreciate about myself is..." And you can fill in the blanks. "My beautiful hair, my wonderful skin, my gorgeous smile, my pure spirit, my compassionate heart." Peace out.
At midnight, we're gonna let it all hang out. At
after midnight, we're gonna let it on in. I see. After midnight, we're gonna